This is Where Did the Road Go? Our aim is to explore the fringe, to be true skeptics and question openly, to investigate the paranormal, bring light to the dark corners of history, and give a voice to the shunned of science. We deal in mystery and the important questions that these subjects bring to light. What is reality? Who are we? And why are we here? Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com for a full show archive, links to all our social media, upcoming schedule, and much, much more. Now, join your host Soraya on this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
Welcome to the show. This interview tonight was conducted, about a month ago. Luke and I talked with Artie Sixkiller Clark about her new book, Sky People: Untold Stories of Alien Encounters in Mesoamerica. And Dr. Artie Sixkiller vowed as a teenager to follow in the footsteps of two 19th century explorers, John L. Stevens and Frederick Catherwood, who brought the ancient Maya cities to the world's attentions. Dr. Clark set out on a seven-year adventure from 2003 through 2010 through Belize, Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico, collecting stories of encounters, sky guards, gods, giants, little people, and aliens among the indigenous people. She drove more than 12,000 miles, visiting 89 archaeological sites and conducting nearly 100 individual interviews. She has degrees in history, English, psychology, and educational leadership, and a background as a teacher, university professor, junior college and university administrator, licensed therapist and psychologist, and social science researcher. She's a professor emeritus at Montana State University and a former director of the Center for Bilingual and Multicultural Education. Dr. Clark, who is Cherokee Kota, has worked with, Kota, has worked with indigenous people for most of her career. Her first book was also on the field of ufology, and that was called Star People: Untold Stories of American Indians, and this time she went a little further south to talk about them. So we're going to get into this, and the next 2 weeks, I think we're going to be hearing our interview with Rick Strassman, which we actually did the same day. And we did both of his books, and we did in two parts because there's no way we could squeeze all that into one interview. We'll see what happens after that. I do intend on doing the listener stories one. I just haven't had enough time to put it together, so I haven't done it yet. But that will be coming up as well. We have Joshua Cutchin talking about his book, A Trojan Feast, Food in the Paranormal Realm. We do have Mike Cleland and Aaron Gully is coming back August 1st. For anyone who missed it, Mike actually had fallen asleep last week, which is why we weren't able to do part four last week. I think the show's on a little later than he normally stays up. So no big deal. We're going to do it on August 4th instead. And we're going to be doing some midweek podcasts. So if you're listening to this on the radio, you might want to check the website out and check out some of the midweek podcasts we're going to be having coming up. Some really interesting stuff there. There's also videos up on our YouTube page. We video anytime someone is in studio, so you can see the conversation as well as listen. And we have some video interviews up. There's all video section on the website, so go take a look there. Or just connect into our YouTube or Vimeo. All right. Without any further ado, this is Artie Sixkiller Clark talking about her book, Sky People. So how you doing, Artie?
I'm doing great.
All right. And you're in Montana right now, right?
Right. Just a beautiful day in Montana. We really appreciate those because sometimes we don't have too many of them.
Really?
Well, it was snowing a few days, or was it 2 days ago? It was
really?
It was 24 degrees last night.
Oh. And what is it today?
Well, 57.
Oh, well, that's not too bad.
Yeah.
Now, you've spent a couple of years down in Central America at this point researching these different UFO stories.
Over a seven-year period, I probably spent a couple of years there, right?
And you were saying in your book that you've, for the most part, not had any bad experiences?
Not really. You know, of course, I was careful. I had people who guided me and who took very good care of me, and also who cautioned me about potential dangers. And I followed their advice. So I really, you know, I had some experiences that I probably should have been more frightened than I was. You know, I was stopped on my way to I was on the Gulf of Mexico and going to Veracruz, and was stopped out on the highway by these hooded men, and there was a truck facing me that had a automatic machine gun mounted on a flatbed truck. But it turned out to be the police, and they were hooded, and they were had to protect themselves from the drug cartels, because if they could identify them, of course, they would, you know, kill their families or be under threat. So it's very difficult in Mexico. You know, you're dealing with a really organized cartels, and they're in Guatemala as well, and they're, you know, Honduras. I mean, they're just not as blatant, as we're not as familiar with them because of Mexico is our neighbor.
Right.
And everything flows through Mexico that's coming up, you know, to this part of the world. But no, I never, you know, I was stopped by military a lot. You know, they had checkpoints for illegal aliens and drugs. They're after the illegal aliens coming from Honduras and Guatemala. But now I understand they're just kind of letting them go right on through Mexico to the United States, recognizing that they don't want to stay there. But
right.
It's a different part of the world, and you just have to be very careful.
Now you're, they considered you one of them.
I think that was a real advantage that I had, because being indigenous, and of course, you know, being able to relate to them stories. I remember one story at. We came up on a turtle, and I asked, you know, what kind of a turtle is this? Does this turtle bite? And then I proceeded to tell them a story from my childhood about a time I captured a turtle, and I built a dam and put the turtle in it, and the turtle didn't want to stay in the dam, and I thought I had made the most beautiful place in the world for this turtle. And I couldn't understand, so I'd go over every couple of hours, and I'd pick this turtle up that was crawling up the mountainside and putting back in this little pond I made for him. And my grandmother, you know, said, where are you going? And I said, well, I got a turtle, and I built a home for him. So she said, well, I better look and see what you're doing. And she goes over to this little creek with me where I'd built this home for this turtle. And I said... She took one look at this turtle, and she said to me, well, that's a snapping turtle, and if he bites you, he's going to hold on to you until it thunders. So I see myself walking around with this turtle hanging on my hand. So I was telling these Maya friends about this, and they said, we have the same story. We tell our kids the same thing. And so they were just fascinated that there was such a connection between the indigenous people of Americas with them. They just said, we do the same thing with our children. We tell those children the same story. We tell them those turtles will hold on until it thunders. And I found those things kind of, you know, people are people, and what's so interesting is to find those connections. And then you do become one of them. You are one of them. And so it was an... it became a journey of love for me.
All right. Now, this book is called Sky People.
Right.
And this came out when?
Came out in December of 2014. But I had a previous book.
Right.
Called Encounters with Star People, and that one was American Indians and Alaska Natives. And then this one deals with indigenous people in Belize, Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico.
Okay. And do you see a big difference between the two?
Well, not a great deal of difference. I think some of the explanations certainly vary, but I don't, and I think there's more fear related to UFOs in that part of the world than there is among American Indians. And fear in terms of superstition. You know, that there's a lot of superstition in that part of the world that carries over into some of the villagers' explanations of things.
Right.
And even
right.
religion can play a huge role because, you know, you've got evangelical churches making a major inroad into that part of the world and are Pentecostal, and they, you know, interpret UFOs and aliens as devils for most part. And then you've got people are confused about what they should believe. And so that's another factor that and you don't have that among American Indians.
Yeah. When I'm reading these stories, they remind me a lot of the type of stories you would have heard coming out of Europe or America in the 50s and 60s.
Well, and that's not surprising to me, because if you go to that part of the world and you go to the villages, it almost reminds you of living in the 40s and 50s in America. Houses are small. The majority of the people are still living as they did thousands of years ago in these small earthen huts that are built of sticks with dirt floors and palapa roofs, you know, which is a jungle of frond from trees that they make their roofs out of. People who have more money now build them out of cinder block, but a few of them have floors. The wealthier, perhaps, so people have a little bit more money or have a job someplace where they can, you know, actually purchase a lot of things. They can build their houses for nothing, you know, out and go out and get the things out of the jungle they need. They don't have not all the places have electricity. Not all the people have electricity. I say maybe half have running water in these small villages. You know, they don't have access to television the way we do today. You know, at best, it's one or two channels. Even in the big tourist centers and tourist areas where there are these major ancient cities, you don't have, even in the big hotels, you know, the 4- and 5-star hotels, you get one or two channels of TV if you're lucky. And so there's no CNN or English-speaking TV shows that are piped into these places, because they barely have TV in Spanish. So, you know, you don't have a lot of exposure to the media like we do in this country. And that's what was so fascinating to me is here you have a group of people that actually do not have exposure so that they can't be influenced by what the media is saying, how other people are describing UFOs, and yet their descriptions almost mirror what you hear in the Western world. Their descriptions of abductions are almost what you hear mirrored and I think that really adds validity to what people in the Western world are saying, because here's a group of people that are experiencing the same thing, and yet they're not seeing TV shows on Nat Geo and Discovery Channel and History Channel about UFOs.
Right.
You know, I can turn on TV anytime here, and I can switch to a channel that's got something about a UFO on it, you know? But you don't see that in that part of the world. So here are people describing the same kind of spacecraft, the same kind of aliens, the same kind of experiences, and that, to me, really adds validity to it.
They also don't need hypnosis to remember these experiences, which is one of the big arguments against American abductions, North American abductions and such in the Western culture.
One of the things that has interested me so much in that is, you know, you often find in this country, you know, people who have clear memories of what happened to them. But the majority of them seem to be hypnotized and relive those experiences through hypnosis. I don't have a problem with that if, you know, this person is a highly trained person. I don't question their ability to do that. But one of the things that people have told me repeatedly is that they have been told that, first of all, that the aliens that are abducting people are aliens who do not want to draw a lot of attention to themselves. They like to choose areas that are indiscreet, areas where they wouldn't particularly expect anybody else to see them. They also, according to people who tell me stories, when you go on board a spacecraft, that what they're told is that 99% of the people who are maybe not quite that many, but they will not ever remember. And they believe it is because there's something that is put into the atmosphere, some kind of a chemical that induces a lethargy as well as a destruction of memory. I had one woman tell me that they offered her a pill-like thing and said, you know, take this and you won't remember. And she said, but I want to remember. My participants have told me is that what the aliens say about that is that they don't care if only 10% of the people remember, because nobody's going to believe them anyway. If 90% remembered, then that would be a problem for them. But if only 10% remember, and so mostly, then repeatedly, I mean, I interviewed a young man not too long ago who was a college student, and he had a most remarkable story to tell, but he said, please don't put this on Facebook. Please don't ever tell my who I am, because if a potential employer would ever find out, I wouldn't get a job.
Right.
And so there is that concern. Now, of course, the people that I talked to were more afraid of the government finding out that they were telling me these stories, and they were about losing jobs because, you know, that didn't seem to be a concern, but they were afraid that the government wouldn't appreciate them talking to me.
All right. There also seems to be a lot of superstition involved in these things as well. Some of the people thinking that they were devils, and the occasional belief that they were angels when they healed them or such. And there seems to also be a difference where some people were telling you, okay, there's the sky people who the Maya descended from, and then there are the interlopers who are the ones coming in and can do good or bad to the people.
Right. Yes, they made a distinction there that in the beginning there were the sky gods, you know, that came from the heavens. And then today, because of the advancements apparently that have been made, there are a lot of different species out there that are visiting the Earth, and they're not all benevolent. There are those that are malevolent, and some believe that some of the people I've interviewed believe that they have designs upon the planet. They could care less about the people. They just have designs upon the planet, that Earth is a beautiful place. And so they're watching out to protect the planet, not to protect the people, as so many of them have been misled to believe. A lot of people say, you know, they can make you think and believe anything they want you to. So if you're an environmentalist and you worry about the planet Earth, then they can implant in your mind all kinds of ideas about how they will step in and save the planet, and how they have to carry this message of peace back to the people. But those are implanted ideas because they can make you think anything. I've had young children tell me that, you know, when they were a young child, they thought they were playing with Mickey Mouse, or they thought they were playing with their twin, or they thought they were playing with a bunny rabbit, and it becomes an alien that takes them on board this craft. So the ability to infiltrate the mind and to create all kinds of different misconceptions, you know, of what they're seeing, appears to be a tactic that is used.
Do you find that most of these experiences are generally intergenerational?
A lot of them are. A lot of them are. I mean, I've interviewed people that tell me that they have been abducted since they were a child. Some of them it stops when they reach adulthood. Others go on for until they reach an old age. And I interviewed a man down in Wyoming, a Wyoming Indian cowboy. He was a character, and he told me that he was taken on board a craft, and they performed all of these different things. They put him inside this tube, and they checked him from one end to the other. And then they said, "Well, how old are you?" And he said, "When I told them how old I was, they said, 'Well, we don't need you.'" And they let him go. And he said, "They don't want old people." He said, "That's one advantage." And he told a story of being abducted when he was out night fishing. So, and it was a really interesting story because in my research, I've found that there are other people who have reported similar occurrences.
Okay. There is a wide variety of the beings that are seen in these encounters.
Right.
And one of the things you find, especially after like Missing Time and Communion came out in North America, the grays became the dominant form people were seeing. But that's not the case down in Central America at all.
No, I had, you know, tall white beings of actually of giants, 7-8 feet tall, the grays and the lizard-like, and another person, you know, described small beings that looked like insects to him. You know, he said that he would have shot it and killed it if he had seen it in the jungle, probably taken it home and eaten it. And you know, he said, but this, you know, they just came out of this ball of fire. He saw the spacecraft fly over him, and he was just trying to make sense out of how something could fly over him like that, not make a sound, and not have wings. And, you know, just these amazing events that have occurred out in the middle of nowhere, you know.
Right, right. And there's a lot of legends, too, about the giants and dwarves in that area.
Oh, yeah. The little people are quite prominent. You know, I visited with an elder down on the banks of the on the ocean, you know, on the beach, and I had gone to this. I had read about these when I was following it, as you well know, if you've read the book, in the footsteps of these ancient explorers who went there in the 1830s and 40s, and they basically are, well, Stevens is considered the father of archaeology, American archaeology, and Catherwood was an architect and an artist, and so he drew all the cities that they saw. And before they went there, nobody really knew that they existed. In fact, their colleagues told them, you know, keep yourself at home. And, you know, you're just following, you know, some legend. And but I had read about Stevens and Catherwood. In their book, they talk about going by this city. They were on the ocean, and that they went by this city, and it said, but it just had these little small buildings and stuff, and so they didn't go there. And the name of it was El Rey, and so I went looking for El Rey, and it's right outside of Cancun. I know that tourists go to Cancun. That's one of the favorite tourist areas in the world, and yet they'd probably never know this place even exists. But I could stand in the middle of El Rey and look up toward the sky and see the Sheraton Hotel. So that's how close it is to Cancun. But anyway, I met this elder who told me that, you know, El Rey was built by the little people. And he told me that when the Maya first came there to that part of the world, that they were greeted by the little people, that the little people were the first inhabitants. And he went on to tell me that they were childlike, because they were they looked like children, so they acted like children. Said they could take many different forms. They could be all kinds of different animals. But he said, if you go there and you sit there, he says you might hear a sound or see a shadow, or a wind might brush your face. And that could be an Alusha, too. Alusha is what they call them. And he said, but mostly they like to impersonate iguana. He said they can be parrots and bats and lizards. Well, if you've been to Mexico, you know you've seen plenty of iguana. And so when I went to El Rey, and I'm walking around, these iguana perched on everything there. He also told me that they like Coca-Cola, and they like tequila. So I made sure that before I left, that I found a nice place to leave a bottle of Coca-Cola.
Nice.
Because he said that was their favorite.
Now, the Maya believe they're descended from some of these sky people, that they're not the same as other people on Earth.
Well, and they are different. You know, the one thing that's so uniquely different about the Maya is that we know that when they arrived in that part of the world over 3,000 years ago, or 4,000 years ago, that they brought their knowledge with them. Now, if you look at almost all indigenous cultures, talk about how they received their knowledge, whether it's from something that came up out of the earth, something that came to them in the night, something, you know, they always had somebody that gave them their knowledge when they arrived at a certain place on Earth. Whereas the Maya, they talk about bringing their knowledge with them. I mean, they developed their calendar based on knowledge that they already had. They knew about, they built their cities based on their knowledge of the universe. So it wasn't something they achieved or learned on Earth, or at least not in the areas where they lived. And there's no history of where they received this knowledge and how they came to be such excellent astronomers and excellent agriculturalists and horticulturalists and their artwork and their designs are just and how they were able to build these cities. All of that knowledge is knowledge that they brought with them when they came to this particular place on the planet. So there are those elders who believe that they did come from another world. And then there are others that say, no, they didn't think that was true. They just weren't quite sure where they came from. Some said, well, we came from corn. The Creator made corn, made us of corn. So, you know, there you have it. That's their, you know, whether.
So, Do you find that most of the stories or the stories about UFO sightings in your book, Sky People, coming from indigenous groups in Mesoamerica, reflect a similarity to the myths and legends of the culture? Or is there a similarity, or do you think that it's just sightings of today?
Well, that's some of them. You know, if you look at the Stone Woman of Belize, for example, you know, that goes back, you know, to a time when this young hunter was going out to hunt for game, and he lives in this village near an ancient city that had been abandoned. And he has to walk through this ancient city to get to the jungle, and as he's passing by, he sees this beautiful woman standing in front of this temple. She's all dressed in white. She has this flowing black hair and red lips, and she's standing there, not moving. So she was called the... And so he throws away his weapon. He rushes back to the village. He brings all these people from the village out to see her, and she's gone. And so the legend grows, and the story goes that she's seen every once in a while, and she disappears inside this cave that's below the temple, or inside the temple. And people talk about how beautiful she is and how wonderful she is, and that, you know, but they call her the Stone Woman of Belize. Well, I had heard there had been some recent sightings of the Stone Woman, and so I had gone to this place to talk to some of the elders there. And I came across this shaman. He was a priest of the village, the traditional priest, and he said to me, he said, well, she comes on us on a UFO, and they beam her down from the sky. And I said, how do you know this? And he said, well, I've seen it. He said, the problem is she is so powerful that anyone who looks into her eyes, she can make you believe what she wants you to believe. And I discovered her technique, and so I avoid her eyes so I can give you a true story of what's going on. He said, my grandfather always said she came from the stars. My father always said, and I can confirm it, he says, that she comes from the stars. She comes down on a beam of light. She walks around the temple. She goes into the cave. She comes out, and she returns on a beam of light. So that's where you see a real connection with the ancient stories and the stories that are being told today. And there, right, there were more instances of that. You know, I met four university students up in Monte Alban in the state of Oaxaca, who told me the story of an ancient story of a being that came down from the sky on a beam of light, and he founded this he married a earth woman who would have been a Zapotec, and he literally built this city with the help of the families that lived there, and he did irrigation, and he did all these wondrous things to help the city prosper. And the city is built on like a salt thing, and so it became a major trade center. When his son was born and he married, after the son grew up and married, then he went back and stood on this rock, and a beam of light came down and took him back to the sky, and he was never seen again. So these are stories that you hear throughout Mexico from the elders and from the people who have a love for those stories and have carried on that tradition, that oral tradition.
Okay. One of the things I found really interesting is there's a number of stories where people see balls of light that transform into these beings, or they're at some of these ancient sites and balls of lights come down,
right.
They transform into these people, and then they walk through like some of the walls and such of these things as if they're looking for something.
Right. I see that not only in Central America and Mexico, but also in the United States, you know, and that these balls of energy have the ability to morph into humans or human-like characters and then communicate. And you hear this all the time down in Central America, even in places like Costa Rica and some of those places I've traveled. You know, they have those lights that people will see in the jungle there that, morph into other creatures.
Okay. I was also fascinated, like I said, about them walking around these ancient sites as if they're looking for something. One of the stories you tell is how they look like they were digging for something while
right.
someone was watching.
Right. And people say they see that all the time, as though they're looking for something that somebody left, maybe an ancestor left. And the one of the stories they told me about digging up the skeleton of a creature, and it came to life and walked onto the spacecraft.
Hmm. Okay. Now, there's also stories, along with the abduction stories, you have a few stories in there where they've taken people and the people haven't come back.
Right. And that was one of the saddest stories I heard. I met this young woman in Merida. She was a dual citizen of the United States and Mexico. Her father was Mexican. Her mother was American. She had only lived in the United States during her college years, and otherwise she made her home in Mexico. She had returned there after graduating from college because her father was alone. Her mother had passed from cancer. And she told me this story about when they were teenagers. She and her sister woke up in the middle of the night with this bright light, woke them up. And on their way outside, they woke their brother. And he followed them out, and they watched this spacecraft was hovering over their backyard. And she said all of a sudden these bright lights came out of it. And these little balls of fire, she said. And she said, my brother raced toward them, and he says, I'm going to touch them. When he saw them become humanoid, I'm going to touch them, and I'll be right back. And they called to him, but he didn't come back. And she said, then all of a sudden, the entire backyard was just filled with this mist. And then when it cleared, my brother was gone and never came back. And so, you know, her father, who was quite well off, offered a huge reward. He was waiting for a ransom. He thought maybe he had been kidnapped, but nothing ever came forth. And they had about 200 workers there on their ranch and fruit groves, and they sent them out searching for him, and he was no evidence. And they tried to tell their dad, but he didn't want to listen. He thought it was nonsense. But she said, you know, I still see UFOs come to this area, and every time I wonder if it's my brother, and if he had something that was so important to do that he had to go away, and I hope someday he will come back and see us. But it's a very sad story.
Yeah.
Because, well, obviously, she was very troubled by it. But, you know, she wasn't the only one who told me stories of people leaving with aliens. I had somebody to say that, you know, you could make a choice. If you wanted to go with them, they'd take you.
You also have a bunch of stories where not just stories from individuals, but also legends about how some of the elders would talk to the sky people, go off on their ships and come back. And you had a few people you talked to who claimed to do that as well.
Right. That's during their ceremonies that they have the ability to do that.
Let's see.
And they tell me that they speak Mayan.
You mentioned that.
Speak Mayan. And it reminded me of the story of the Navajo Indian, you know, when he found out that American astronauts were going to land on the moon. He sent him a message and says, tell him hello for us. And then he told the reporter who was interviewing him, you know, we've been there before. And to make sure they tell him us. So, you know, I had to think about the fence.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about the Brother of the Red Hand and the Shining People.
Well, you know, this was one of the most unexpected interviews I ever did. You know, I had been, for two or three nights, I'd been staying at my driver's sister's house, and she was an English teacher, and she just welcomed me into her home and said, oh, please stay. We got these celebrations going on, and you need to participate. And so I decided to stay for a few days. And when we left and on our way back to Guatemala City, she had passed for us, and we just pulled off the road and stopped in this wide space and, you know, talking about just sitting in the outside, just talking about everything that we had seen and experienced. And this elderly man came up to us, and he said that behind you, in, hidden in this jungle, is an ancient site. And he said, I'm the caretaker. Well, come to find out, he wasn't the caretaker at all. He was the caretaker, but he was a self-appointed caretaker who had decided that when the government at one time had built a caretaker's house, but then decided not to do anything with it. And so the site was never excavated. So he had actually moved into this caretaker's house to keep the people from looting.
Mm.
And so he took us around. We gave him lunch, and we shared our lunch with him, and then I gave him some paperback books because he was a very good English speaker, and he had once been an illegal immigrant in the United States, he told me. But anyway, he took us to this spot where he said to sit on this bench that he had built, because he comes there, and he said, this is the altar of the people of the Red Hand, and of the Shining People. And I said, well, who are the Shining People? And he said, well, they're the sky people, the star people. They come here to this, they've been coming here for centuries. And he said, we're sitting on this bench, and there's this, the only structure that's standing on the whole place is this sod of a building. And across the front of this building, and it's just the front that's standing, are these red hands. And he starts to tell me that among the Shining People are the people of the Red Hand. And they were the collectors of knowledge and the dispensers of knowledge all over the world. So every place that you would go, you saw the Red Hand, you would see that the people of the Red Hand had been there, and that they already gathered the knowledge and shared the knowledge that they had with the people who had lived there. I found that to be a fascinating story.
Yeah, so did I. And it's a complete odds with what archaeologists believe on that, isn't it?
So many people say, well, it's just the signature of the builder, you know, and he said, that's not true. That is not what it is. And, you know, I have people all over the world write to me about handprints, the red handprints. You know, all over Europe, people have written me, Australia, you know, it's really interesting how people connect with that story.
A lot of these people will talk about their ancestors, and at some point in the book, you explain that that ancestors doesn't always mean blood relatives.
Right. Yeah, an ancestor is those who've gone before, and that's pretty commonly held in among indigenous people. The ancestors are those who have gone before.
Okay. You also talk a bit about Erich von Däniken in there, and what exactly? How do you feel about his ancient astronaut theories?
I think they're ethnocentric. Basically, what he's saying is that these dumb Mayans couldn't have possibly built these cities. They were savages, or, you know. And that is how the Western world had viewed the indigenous populations of the world, that they were heathens. They weren't Christianized. They had to be converted to Christianity because, you know, and yet if you look at the laws that the majority of indigenous people lived by, they were more holy and more, you know, I mean, they really had very strict laws. I mean, you know, if you look at some of the early writings of the founders of this nation, they can't get over the fact that in these Indian villages, for example, there were no needs for prisons or jails because the penalty of doing something wrong fit the crime. You know, you kill somebody's son, then you become that person's son, and you have to work for him the rest of your life.
Huh.
You know, if you do something to her, or that person could say, I don't want him to be my son. I want him to be banished from the tribe forever. So there were laws that were very specific, and there wasn't any black and white. This is the way it was, you know. And so Benjamin Franklin marveled at that, how it worked. And there was no need to put people in prison because, and so, you know, that isn't a savage society. It isn't a savage society when people have art and storytelling and they have stories and they have alphabets. And yet that's exactly what occurred every place that people encountered indigenous people, that they couldn't possibly be intelligent enough to build these cities. And that's basically what Van Deneken is saying.
Right. Okay.
And you know, every archaeologist has discounted his theories, but there seems to be, you know, he seems to have a huge following. I mean, my goodness, look at all the books he sold.
Yeah.
You know, it's just amazing. And yet archaeologists are saying this is wrong. This is not what happened.
Some of the stories of the giants, the people you talked to said that they don't really come around much anymore, and that the giants were pretty vicious beings in some cases.
Yes, and they did make a distinction. They said they're the giants of the blue kind, and then there are these other giants, and the blue kind, you know, were noted for kidnapping, of taking women and children, of they had the ability to walk through walls and do all sorts of things. And the people strongly felt that the giants of the blue kind were ones that were becoming an extinct race. I haven't seen them for a long time, you know, maybe 20, 30 years.
You also say that the sky people don't like tourists, and some of the areas have been completely abandoned by them because they're become tourist attractions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the places where many of the sky people came was more or less a place of rest and a place for meditation, or became a holy place, a sacred place for the people. And the tourists are running all over there and snapping selfies and doing all their things. I mean, you just sometimes cringe when you're in that part of the world, and you know, you hear this guy from who knows where, he's got a half a dozen cameras hanging around his neck, and he's yelling, you know, for Chichen Itza, he says, oh, this chicken pizza really looks great. And you just see why the sky gods wouldn't want to come there anymore, you know. Jesus, just, you know. You know, but you see that all the time.
Okay. And a lot of these people also have very apocalyptic messages. When they get some of these messages about how the sky people will save the Maya as the fourth world ends.
Well, I think that's a New Age concept. That's not a Maya belief. You know, that's why you had a million people go to Chichen Itza and to different places in Mexico and Peru, you know, thinking that, you know, the UFOs were going to come and save them. I don't hear that among the Maya. The Maya believe that when one world ends, another begins.
Right.
There's
but
no break there.
You did relate some stories, though, that the world would be essentially destroyed and the Maya would be the ones who survive.
And which story is that?
I don't remember.
Well, I don't remember that one either. I know that there was a story like that in my first book, Encounters with Stars. But no, I don't remember that. I'm trying to figure out which one that would be.
It was near the end. It was someone saying that the Maya would be the ones who are saved and they know how to survive, and that's, you know, I'm trying to look it up now, but I'm not.
Well, not that the UFOs are going to have anything to do with it.
Oh, well, there was
well,
part of that.
UFOs weren't going to take them away. I thought that's what
you
were
saying. No.
Well, I think, you know, you may be talking about the time the elders were talking about, you know, great catastrophes happen all the time. And, you know, what, you know, the Maya haven't disappeared at all. When Cortez came to that part of the world and all the cities were abandoned, they were abandoned long before Cortez ever went there. The Maya freaks had already into the jungle, with the exception of two cities, two smaller cities were still inhabited. And he was telling me that he thinks that what had happened is a great catastrophe had fallen them, whether it was a tsunami, you know, a drought, or, you know, a hurricane, something happened. And, you know, today scientists are saying there was a 100-year drought in that part of the world that went all the way up through Arizona and New Mexico. Covered right. That entire section of the world. You think about a 100-year drought and the impact that it would have. You know, look at the drought we have now in this western United States. And he was saying that there are those who will survive, and they'll always survive because they, you know, just like the Maya survived, people think there are no more Maya. Well, there are 15 million of them at last count. And, you know, and a high percentage of those 15 million, I'd say a good 90% still live in the old ways, you know, at least don't live in modern society as most people would think.
Okay.
But I don't know where the one is that you said the UFOs are going to come and take them away.
Well, they didn't say that. They said the sky people would protect them, I think is what it was.
Well, that's a lot different, you know. I mean, it may be that, you know, they would be able to, for their prayers and stuff, that there would be some protection there.
And that it was only the people who had held the true beliefs of the Maya would be saved.
You're talking about the Lacandon?
Possibly, yes.
That they held their traditional ways and live out in the jungle still, and those are very radical opinions, but not a common opinion expressed by Maya by any means.
Okay,
The Lacandon were, you know, I mean, their son told me that when the last Lacandon Indian died, that would be the end of the world. Is that the one you're talking about? Because, you know, I mean, they had very different views of. But, you know, they are from a culture that wasn't even discovered until 1958.
Really?
They were a separate section of the Maya who went deep into the jungle to stay away from any influence. So they weren't even discovered until 1958. And so they are very, very removed from what we call civilization and have tried to keep it that way. And the Mexican government has tried to keep it that way, too.
How come?
Well, because they want to respect the people. They
don't want
tourists going to their villages and, you know, that kind of thing.
Okay. Now, you've had your own UFO sightings.
Oh, yeah.
You want to tell people a little bit about that?
No, I don't. I don't like to talk about those things. You know, maybe one day I'll write a book about it, but right now I want to focus on the stories of the people.
Well,
okay. Well,
I was like, what I did find interesting was that in your story, Encountered with the Old Ones, you were told that you might have an impact on the tourism in the area for the work that you were doing. So I was wondering if you ever went back and did you notice a change based from
your stories?
No,
I have never made it back. I am Honduras is a dangerous place.
Yes.
Much more dangerous than some, you know, there's a lot of gangs at Rome, and it's not an easy place to travel in.
Right.
And you have been back to a lot of the places initially.
I've been back to a lot of them, but Guatemala and Honduras are far more dangerous than Mexico.
Now, when you go back to these places, do people come up to you with more stories?
Sometimes. You know, and of course I go back to see old friends, and I'm going back in January.
Mm.
I can't wait, you know. to get back and get out in the jungle again, because I still at home there. The people are very humble, they're very welcoming, and they're, you know, I look forward to it.
Okay. You do have some stories about cattle mutilations in here. Now, do these cattle mutilations that are happening down there mirror the stuff that happens in the United States?
Seems to. You know, I'm not an expert on cattle mutilation, but I had that one story in there from Honduras. Where the young man had a ranch, and he had even hired some people to stay up with the cattle all night. And yet, when they saw this bright light in the star, both of them spoke about this. All of a sudden, it felt like thousands and thousands of needles punching into their skin, and they lost consciousness. And then that morning, you know, they went back home to sleep, and when they came back to work that night, they found out the cattle had been mutilated.
And you also have an interesting story of a dead crocodile.
Oh yeah, that happened at Coba. You know, Coba is an interesting place. It's deep in the jungle. It's accessible by a highway, but it has the distinction of having the highest pyramid in all of the Yucatan. It's a mosquito-infested place because there's so many passageways of water and lagoons and everything around this site. And I met this young man there who was a taxi escort at the site, and he told me the story about seeing a crocodile. He was walking home after work just at the edge of darkness, and he saw this spacecraft come in over the lagoon, and he said he hid in the reeds and the weeds and saw them take a crocodile onto their spaceship. 2 days later, he was walking with his friend, and both of them saw the crocodile return to the lagoon and another one taken. It made him very afraid.
I bet.
Said he told his wife and children, you know, don't ever stay outside after dark. He said, I heard they take people, but I never thought they would take a crocodile.
Yeah. And you also have one where they switched to chicken, which brings to mind.
And they ate it because the mother thought it was a devil chicken.
Yeah, because it was black instead of white, which was the original chicken.
Right. Yeah.
It reminds me of a changeling story from, like, the fairy faith.
Oh, really? I don't know what that is.
Where they would take children and return and replace it with a different child.
Oh, well, maybe the aliens aren't so perfect after all. I told him that's what happened. They made a mistake and gave you back the wrong chicken.
One of the stories I like that's at the beginning of the book is, it might even be the first chapter, the backwards walking people.
Right. I heard that story the first night I was in Belize from a young woman. My driver and I had crashed his cousin's wedding reception. And so, you know, I was at odds about what I was supposed to be doing there. And In the evening, the women all kind of went downstairs and started washing up the dishes and everything, from serving the people, and I went down with them, and there had been a sighting of a UFO earlier that night in the capital city. And so they started talking about it, and the next thing I know, this young woman starts talking about the backward-walking people. She had, that's what she named them, because she said they could walk backward, and when they walked backward, they could swivel their head around to look as though they were going forward. So she thought that was, that they were, she imitated how they walked and how they could swivel their head around, and she said they had been coming to her grandfather's farm for a very long time, because her grandfather had saw them, her father had saw them, and she had seen them, and she had seen them too. Not had all, I mean had seen.
Right. That's a very unique description. I don't think I've ever heard that one before.
I haven't either, and it's the only time I've heard it, you know, and her cousin, he had seen them and agreed to it too. You know, he said they do exist.
You also have the cases of women becoming pregnant and then having the pregnancies disappear, which is which we do see also in the Western cases in the United States and stuff. And I noticed a few of them took it as kind of a miracle, like the Virgin Mary.
Well, that was their first interpretation of it, because this young woman was a virgin. And how else could it be, because she and her boyfriend hadn't had relationships, and so he decided to protect her because he saved her, and he told her it must be like the Virgin Mary, it must be a virgin birth. You have to keep in mind that a lot of the villagers are very steeped in the Catholic religion and can explain away things through the miracles of the Bible. And, you know, I don't have a problem with that. It's an interesting, different way of expressing it. And, of course, you know, a few months later, she's no longer pregnant. Hmm. And this time she's attributes it to the UFO that had taken her baby. She never really connects the fact it doesn't seem like that it was a hybrid baby or something, or maybe they planted a baby, but she can't have her own children now, so that is a concern too.
All right, Luke, do you have any other questions?
No, it's just, it was a very interesting book. I appreciated a lot of the outlook and perspective from it.
Well, I did too. You know, it's just it humbles me to be able to collect these stories and to tell them to the people. I'm working on my third book now, and I have been interviewing, 78% of the Native American population in this country does not live on reservations. They live in urban areas, they live in small towns and in rural areas, just like me. There are people who've relocated because of jobs, work, or whatever, and or marriage, and although they have close connections with their reservations, or they have keeping, you know, with an Indian center that may be in their community, or in their city, And the majority of them, I would say, were born on reservations. So I'm telling their stories next.
Awesome. When do you think that might be released?
Probably not until the following June, probably June 2016.
Okay. All right. You just have the two out now then, Star People and Sky People.
Right. And my webpage is sixkiller.com, and if anybody has any comments or they want to write me, feel free to do that at ardy@sixkiller.com. I had a lot of people writing down me stories, people, you know, who write about my book, people who have questions, so feel free to write me.
All right, and I very much enjoyed the book. It's very well written, and the way you tell you tell it in a story-like fashion, so you're not just relating the dry information. You're talking about what it's like to be there, the experiences you had leading up to the stories themselves, and I think that makes it a lot more interesting and a lot more real to read.
Well, thank you, and I'm happy to hear that you enjoyed that style.